for welcoming everybody. I thought I would talk for a few minutes today, going all the way back to something that we talked about at the end of December and we're supposed to talk about again about a week or two later, and then we never got back to it. But we had played a talk that Joan gave at the summer retreat where she talked about the kind of coexistence of pilgrims and teachers of abiding nowhere and abiding deeply, of that sense sometimes when things open up to whatever degree of things being evanescent, and that's not a problem, moving from one sensation, one feeling to another, just kind of on the tide of that movement. And that paradoxically, that can also be the place where everything is completely still and radiant and seems eternal. And one of the things that Joan touches on in that discussion is that at those moments, it seems really that we're not caught by our own opinions about things, our own views, and so on. And so the talk that I gave in December and the thing we talked about together after that was, you know, what are some of the things that happens when inevitably opinions and judgments and views return when we're manipulating and manipulated by our own elaborate take on things. Joan calls that sometimes the apparatus, and it reminds me sometimes also of a pinball machine that you're trying to tilt to make it come out how you want to. One of the things I talked about last time was the sense that if things have really opened up for you in a way that feels powerful, that you've really been on a pretty big vacation, at least for a while, from that sense in which you, or that time in which you have to have views and opinions about everything, and when there's a lot of narrative and a lot of predications and judgments going on in your own head. And after those moments, you can really return with a sense of kind of surprise and bemusement to, as John said to me one time, Tennyville. He said, "Welcome back to Tennyville." You know? It's like, oh, it's kind of nice here. It's kind of strange here. I don't live here all the time. You know? So that can happen after you've been away for a while. The other thing that can happen, we talked about this a little bit last time, is those moments of everything kind of opening up or abiding nowhere and abiding deeply may not have happened, for you, they may seem pretty remote if they have. But I think for any of us who've been practicing for a while, there tends to be, and this is a real truism in the trade, but something of a shift in our relation to our own opinions and views and models and truths. It's certainly, for me anyway, a pretty common experience in parts of sits or parts of retreats to just be really lost in sort of jabbering and judgments and views and things like that, and they can seem sometimes very compelling. But it's almost inevitable if we sit for a while, I know all of you know this, that at some point we become aware of those thoughts, of those models, of those opinions and judgments from the outside in some way. And if they've been for most of our lives so habitual and ingrained that we don't even notice that they're there, we come to see them and to get a little bit of distance from them. They seem a little remote. We don't feel so compelled by those stories. They don't feel quite so compelling to us. So instead of it being how the world is, there's a sense that it's how I'm seeing the world, and in some way there's something maybe a little odd about that. Not that a particular view is wrong necessarily, but oh, I thought the world was like this, and it might not be. It might be some other way or many other different ways. And a related experience for many of us is that the narrator, the opinion maker, the interpreter, what we call the self, also, after we sit for a while, seems like it's not the only game in town, that somehow you're observing something from a vantage that doesn't feel identical to the vantage of the interpreter. And in that sense, too, you get a little distance on this kind of narrative and judgmental agency or tendency, especially in moments of real quiet or stillness or spaciousness. So I talked a little bit last time about my sense of the kind of disproportion of means and ends in Zen practice. And it seems to me that, you know, as I said a minute ago, one of the things that could happen is you have some kind of big experience of being free of all that, and then when you return to it, it seems, you know, again, you have a lot of distance from it for at least a fair amount of time. The other thing that might happen is just little shifts, little bits of distance, at some point begin to loosen things up to the extent that you really drop down into a kind of deeper and freer place. I guess the other thing we would say, and it certainly goes along with Joan's notion of bucket work, is that having some distance from our own opinions and views and models is probably a good thing in and of itself. And it occurs to me every once in a while that that might seem like a strange thing to say. I mean, why shouldn't... I mean, I remember Joan saying at some point, so the thing that's wrong with him is he believes the contents of his own mind, which seems like, why not? It's my mind, you know. Why not believe it? And so one of the things, this is the part of the talk that I've been wanting to give for a long time, and it'll probably be really boring, but I want to do it anyway. So it seems to me sometimes maybe that the notion that our own views are just views and, you know, we can step back from them, and that's really important, we might associate it with sort of Eastern way of thinking or something like that. And so I think it's really important that when D.T. Suzuki came to America and was lecturing at Columbia, one of the things he said is that he thought Zen would find really fertile soil here because it was so close in some of its emphases to the native philosophical tradition of American pragmatism. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to read you some James and Emerson for a while. And my idea is that, aside from anything else, since they're focused on the practical or the pragmatic, the notion that even aside from any spiritual register or dimension to this, there's probably something useful, as they would say, you know, about having not quite believing the contents of our own mind, let's say. So I'll just read a couple things, and if it goes on too long, we'll pick it up another day. But so James, you know, was part of a philosophical movement that kind of got going in America in the late 19th century. John Dewey, the great educator, was one of his big sidekicks. But he said that he'd really learned a lot of it from earlier American literature and poets like Whitman and also somebody like Emerson. So the poetic and the literary and the philosophical traditions here really have always intertwined. So let's hope my pagination is right. It's not right. I remember it anyway, I'll just tell you. So there's a passage in, I think it's Emerson's Self-Reliance, where he says that a new system, you know, you read somebody's model, you read Freud, you read Marx, you read Dewey or something like that, and their way of seeing the world seems really powerful to you. And so there's a long period, he says, where for the pupil confuses the walls of the system with the walls of the universe. And what he means, I think, is that we're actually seeing what the model puts there for us to see, but it's so persuasive that we think we've seen through to the core of reality. And that image gets revised in another essay, Circles, where he says actually that what happens is that in some sense, if there's a kind of force or energy that you push through, he talks about models as like, you know, dropping a rock in water and it makes a circle, and so we see to the edge of that circle. But then there could be a bigger circle that dissolves the first, then a bigger circle that dissolves the next one. And in Circles, he says, really, there's no end to that process. So there really never is that moment where the walls of the system give us the walls of the universe. You know, and I think a lot of times in Zen practice, we think that's what we're going to see. We're going to see the walls of the universe and the ultimate structure of things, but probably not, you know. That's not quite what happens. So here's William James talking about a similar kind of desire, I think. It says, when we talk of reality independent of human thinking, then it seems a very hard thing to find. And there, he's not saying that there's no reality outside of human reality. He's saying if you're a human being, it's a pretty hard thing to find. And he's being it's an understatement, so he's being kind of jokey. When we talk of reality independent of human thinking, then it seems a very hard thing to find. It reduces to the notion, and here I think if we do Zen practice, we kind of perk up our ears in some way. It reduces to the notion of what is just entering into experience and is yet to be named. or else to some imagined original presence and experience before any belief about the presence had arisen, before any human conception had been applied. It is what is absolutely dumb and evanescent, and by dumb I don't think it means stupid, but not speaking, the merely ideal limit of our minds. And there's that sense really that it's kind of asymptotic, that we'll never quite get there. We may glimpse it, but we never grasp it. So remember that moment of saying, something's going on for me, but I can't quite grasp what it is. So we may glimpse it, but we never grasp it. Right, that's how it is. What we grasp is always some substitute for it, for which previous human thinking has peptonized and cooked for our consumption. Mm-hmm. So there's always that, you know, that sense of, we're striving for that moment when things fall away and we may get a little bit of glimpse of it. This is not where I really want to go today, but I think one of the interesting things about those moments is that rather than, and I think Zen philosophy is thinking of it this way in the last several years, whereas maybe it didn't always, but in those moments we might think, oh, now we've come face to face with absolute reality, so it's as if the veils have been torn away. The experience often is much more that we're naked to the world in a different way. You know, not that the world was veiled and we're seeing the world without its veils, but that we've taken off the veils of our models and we're available to that space and open to it in a way that we're usually not. You know. So I'm going to read you a few passages backed off from that sort of merely ideal limit where there's no idea or opinion of things, and give you a little bit of what James says about model making. So this is just a tiny little phrase here, but it's a lead into something else I want to quote. He says, "The overwhelming majority of our true ideas admit of no direct or face-to-face verification." That's probably true in human culture and pretty interesting. Like a gigantic amount of stuff that we just take as true. If I said, show me, you know, walk to the place where you can show me, you couldn't do that, all right? Another thing I like about this book is that one of the places that he's drawing his view of what we do when we make models of things is from philosophy of science. So if we think we're just talking about wishy-washy stuff and that real knowledge is different from this, he says, no, you know, talk to your neighborhood physicist, then he'll tell you the same thing. So he says, "It is, as I have already said, as if reality were made of ether, atoms, or electrons, but we mustn't think so literally. The term energy doesn't even pretend to stand for anything objective. It is only a way of measuring the surface of phenomena so as to string their changes on a simple formula." And so the very categories in which we think through things, and again, at the time he was writing, he's talking about stuff that conspicuously was not available to face-to-face verification. You couldn't look at electrons, you know. But the model was very powerful and very predictive, but it would be a mistake probably to confuse the walls of the system with the walls of the universe. And it's useful to keep in mind that what you have is a model that has a certain value, certain usefulness, a certain predictive capacity to it. So here's the formulation of something like that in fuller terms, and specifically with relation to philosophy of science. He says, "One of the most successfully cultivated branches of philosophy in our time is what is called inductive logic, the study of the conditions under which our sciences have evolved. Writers on this subject have begun to show a singular unanimity as to what the laws of nature and element of fact mean when formulated by mathematicians, physicists, and chemists. When the first mathematical..." So now he's saying, oh, back in the old days, here's what people thought, and then he's going to contrast it to how philosophers of science think now. "When the first mathematical, logical, and natural uniformities, the first laws, were discovered, men were so carried away by the clearness, beauty, and simplification that resulted that they believed themselves to have deciphered authentically the eternal thoughts of the Almighty." So if the model's useful, if we want to call it true, we think that therefore it must duplicate the absolute structure of the real. His mind, and so he's paraphrasing what the old guys thought, and he's talking about God's mind. "His mind also thundered and reverberated in syllogisms. He also thought in conic sections, squares, and roots and ratios, and geometrized like Euclid. God made Kepler's laws for the planets to follow. He made velocity increase proportionally to the time in falling bodies. He made the law of the signs for light to obey when refracted. He established the classes, orders, families, and genera of plants and animals." That's pretty important. So If our nomenclature, if our way of categorizing the natural world is effective, then we're tempted to think, oh, we have again discovered the law that God used to make it, or the law that reality in some mathematical sense, you know, used to produce the phenomena themselves, you know, and fix the distances between them. God got the archetypes of all things and devised their variations, and when we rediscover any one of these his wondrous institutions, we seize his mind in its very literal intention. It's worth just for a second sort of jumping tracks and translating that to our own views of our relations with people that we know and our jobs and things around us. And I think it's really, really tempting and really very common that we think that, you know, we believe the contents of our own minds. If we have a view of how it is, we think that's how it is. But as the sciences have developed farther, the notion has gained ground that most, perhaps all, of our laws are only approximations. So what would it be like to take the models that you use in your daily lives, that I use in my daily life, to deal with intimate relations, other things like that, and have the same, you know, and meditation can give us this, the same sense that, ah, you know, it's a way of looking at it, but. The laws themselves, moreover, have grown so numerous that there is no counting them, and so many rival formulations are proposed in all the branches of science that investigators have become accustomed to the notion that no theory is absolutely a transcript of reality, but that any one of them may, from some point of view, prove useful. Their great use is to summarize old facts and to lead to new ones. They are only a man-made language, a conceptual shorthand, as someone calls them, in which we write our reports of nature. And languages, as is well known, tolerate much choice of expression and many dialects, so many possible ways to model it, many possible ways to think it through. Just read you a little more. Let me jump into another one. This is a great passage. And this may or may not concern us really, but one of the things he's arguing is that if something works and it we haven't encountered the terrain in which it proves itself unworkable, that we ought to call it true, and that actually there's no other, you know, valid philosophical meaning to the word true. So if it's working, looks seems true. Right. We'll say some more about that another time. But the true, to put it very briefly, is only the expedient in the way of our thinking, just as the right is only the expedient in the way of our act of our behaving. Expedient in almost any fashion, and expedient in the long run and on the whole, of course. For what meets expediently all the experience in sight won't necessarily meet all farther experiences equally satisfactorily. And so maybe Zen practice makes us more available to the next things he's about to say. Experience, as we know, has ways of boiling over and making us correct our present formulas. Okay. Things change and it's very common to say that the world is fucked up, it doesn't obey my model, but it might be more useful to mess with the model a little bit. The absolutely true, meaning what no farther experience will ever alter, is that ideal vanishing point towards which we imagine that all our temporary truths will someday converge. It runs on all fours with the perfectly wise man and with the absolutely complete experience. And if these ideals are ever realized, and so he's chuckling here, you know, they will all be realized together. You know, so as long as experience is not absolutely complete, things are only relatively true, or as he likes to say, true in so far forth, and it would be really useful then to hold our models lightly. So that's a truth about truths. Right? Meanwhile, we have to live today, and here's riffing on Emerson, by what truth we can get today and be ready tomorrow to call it falsehood. Ptolemaic astronomy, Euclidean space, Aristotelian logic, scholastic metaphysics were expedient for centuries, but human experience has boiled over. That is, you get new instrumentation, new data, a new range of phenomena that the models don't explain too well. Has boiled over those limits, and we now call these things only relatively true, or true within these borders of experience, like Newtonian mechanics, relatively true. Absolutely, they are false, for we know that those limits were casual and might have been transcended by past theorists, just as they are by present thinkers. I'll just read you one more little one, and then we'll stop for today. One place this will go is back around to Uchiyama. So we'll see how we get there. a new opinion, and so opinion could be model, you know, or something like that, metaphor. A new opinion counts as true just in proportion as it gratifies the individual's desire to assimilate the novel, by which he means the new, the experience that has boiled over and something happens that doesn't fit the old model, right? A new opinion counts itself as true just in proportion as it gratifies the individual's desire to assimilate the novel in his experience to his beliefs in stock. So we've always got a lot of opinions, models, ways of processing things, and we're going to have to change them sometimes when the novel experience doesn't seem to fit them at all. It, the new model, right? It must both lean on old truth and grasp new fact. And its success in doing this is a matter for the individual's appreciation. When old truth grows, then, by new truth's addition, it is for subjective reasons. It's working for us, right? We are in the process and obey the reasons. That new idea is truest, which performs most felicitously its function of satisfying our double urgency. It makes itself true, gets itself classed as true by the way it works, grafting itself then upon the ancient body of truth, which thus grows much as a tree grows by the activity of a new layer of cambium. The trail of the human serpent is thus over everything, and I think he's saying all knowledge is fallen, not a problem. You know? Truth independent, truth that we find merely, truth no longer malleable to human need, truth incorrectible in a word. Such truth exists indeed superabundantly, or is supposed to exist, by rationalistically minded thinkers. But then it means only the dead heart of the living tree, and its being there means only that truth also has its paleontology. And he's thinking there, as he talks elsewhere in the book, about the sort of axioms of common sense and how within our realm of experience, the truths of common sense seem to be absolutely true, and therefore they don't change so much. But, you know, once you get out beyond the area of Newtonian mechanics, they don't always work. And its prescription may grow stiff with years of veteran service and petrified in men's regard by sheer antiquity. It's fun for me to think about what the personal instances of those would be. I mean, what are the things that I hold so deeply as a way of, you know, this is who I am, this is how I relate to the world, this is how I treat people, this is how they treat me, that it's almost impossible for me anymore to think that, oh, you know, what would it be like if I didn't see the world that way? What if something made me see the world in a different way? But how plastic even the oldest truths nevertheless really are, malleable, right, has been vividly shown in our day by the transformation of logical and mathematical ideas, a transformation which seems even to be invading physics. The ancient formulas are reinterpreted as special expressions of much wider principles, principles that our ancestors never got a glimpse of in their present shape and formulation. So I'll stop there for now. I'd be happy for any questions or comments or discussion.
I followed what you said. So what is the, how would you pull it all together as, something helpful to be learned from what you just said?
Oh, yeah. I guess what I would say is in retreats, they're when you're very deep in your practice, they're powerful moments, right, where I think we always have models, you know, because there's that Jamesian thing about it's the merely ideal limit, but when most of the stories, most of the narratives, most of the sense that I'm seeing the world in a habitual way have just fallen away, and it really is like the first morning of the world, and your mind really is sticking no place, and you really are abiding nowhere, and you really are like clouds on water, and strangely enough, in those moments, everything seems eternal and absolutely still at the same time, you know? So one of the issues for me would be, so if we don't live there all the time, what happens from that being outside our models for a while to change our relation to the models when we're back in them? You know, we're having an opinion, we're, you know, being judgmental about this person or that person. And I guess I'm trying to suggest two things, I guess. One is that I think on the one hand, and I think this is really important, that even the little tiny grubby versions of it, maybe especially if we have a practice, But there are always moments when the bottom can drop out into something bigger. So I think that's really important. You know, you had an opinion that a certain person is a certain way, and all of a sudden that falls away, and for some strange reason, all of reality starts shining. You know, so I think the loosening from how we see the world always has that possibility for the bottom to drop out of things in an important way. But I also want to suggest, and I think this is, you know, a lot of what I hear you saying a lot of the time, you know, you want to know sort of what the value of it is in terms of your daily experience and how you walk around in the world. And partly by connecting it to James and Emerson, I'm trying to say, you know, yeah, there's a lot of practical utility to it. There's a way in which our sense of sort of flexibility in relation to our own way of seeing things, even when it's not feeling particularly spiritual at all, is a great utility. You know, that.
Yeah, it seems that what I get from it maybe is that there's a lot of trying to figure it out, and really we never can hold on to any of that,
yeah.
And that's what's valuable.
Yeah, yeah.
You know that all of our life is our beliefs are what create our reality.
Yeah. That's the Uchiyama thing that I was trying to.
And so, if we know that in every moment, then we can realize it's just our beliefs and it isn't real. And it is. I understand. And it is.
Yeah.
But to also have that other, to have it all part of one.
Yeah.
You know, not just having this is how I am. This is what I believe. Yes, and it's only because you believe it that you know. I mean, both of those things have to be held together or seen as one, so that we don't grasp at at anything.
Yeah, and the grasping is going to be bad spiritually, and will make us worse drivers on the freeway too, right? Right.
Yeah, grasping is never helpful. I don't.
Yeah.
Think.
No,
so,
but I mean, here's the other thing I like about it. I mean, there's models and judgments are incredibly useful in some way, right? I mean, you wouldn't get around if you didn't have them. So how do you make them as useful as possible? You keep them malleable, you know, you're as open as possible to new experience entering or impinging and so on.
But just know that that's what they are, that they're not the truth.
Yeah, yeah,
and that's the part.
Yeah,
you know,
but, and in James's view, they're the best instrument you have for getting around in the world,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And the moment when they all fall away is the moment where everything's radiant and shining, you know? And then the next moment, it's time to revise the model. You know?
Maybe part of it is not, we tend to grasp at these things that are familiar to our mind, but this process allows us to not grasp as long, you know? It's like you grasp it for a second, recognize it, apply its usefulness, and drop it.
Yeah. I think the Zen part of it, you know, wouldn't be only Zen, but I think also in the moment when the model falls away, and maybe it's not a gigantic thing, but it's like, oh, you realize you took a wrong turn and you have no idea where you are and you've never been there before. That right after that, or right along with that, you get to the true person of no rank right after that.
Mm.
Do you know what I mean? That a lot of what gives you rank is that whole system of structures and judgment, and that kind of openness that you feel with the moment of true person of no rank coming in and out of my face all day, that just you know when the model goes wacko on you for a minute or disappears, you're likely to fall into that also. I think.
Likely to fall into.
Fall into I'm the true person of no rank. You know.
Yeah, as long as you don't grasp for.
Yeah.
Don't let me down. Drop in.
Yeah.
Rank. Yeah.
Yeah. It's sort of like I'm no more known than the world is, you know, something like that.
It's like when in the cartoons, when whoever runs off the cliff and they're still running.
Yeah.
So they can either go, or they can go. In the cartoons, sometimes they'll jump back and manage to grab a hold of the cliff.
The cartoon, did you read Pogo ever? Do you remember Pogo?
Yeah.
I love that. So there's one in one of the books, I can't remember which one, but it's got that mannerist thing, which is sort of like what you're talking about, the same, but they're walking around in this sort of enchanted forest, and one guy turns to the other and says, "Gosh, look at the artwork." Which is like seeing the model all of a sudden. You know? There's a weird thing, I don't know if you know Leslie Scalapino at all, who's a poet who died a couple years ago, is pretty close to Norman Fisher, and ran O Books up in the Bay Area. But there's one book where, and she's very, very, was very involved in Buddhism, and there's a moment where she keeps talking about, or a book where she keeps talking about seeing it on the retina, which is, I think, that thing about seeing. You see, I think the image is, you see the act of your own seeing, and that seems really important to her. So I guess we're out of...
We'll have to talk in here.
So thank you, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Not at all boring, by the way.
Thank you. Thanks.